Caregivers, have you ever felt like nothing is going right? Well, cheer up and welcome to Dave, the Caregivers Caregiver Radio Program on Health Star Worldwide, where you'll learn how to avoid that dreaded thing called caregiver burnout and how to survive the grieving process. They say that there are only three types of people in the world: those who are caregivers, those who will become caregivers, and those who will someday need a caregiver. Join Dave and his guests now and every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Pacific on Health Star Worldwide as they share practice tips and tools that you can start using immediately to help get you through this day so you can live your caregiver life more fully and abundantly. Now, here's your caregiver host, Dave Nassani.
From Los Angeles, Big Ellie, welcome to all my listeners out there in Radio Land. I am Dave, the Caregiver's Caregiver, coming to you live globally through the famous Radio Star Worldwide Network. Yes, folks, I am the guy who's going to help you and who's going to guide you through this very difficult journey called caregiving. Yes, and we're going to do our very best to help you avoid that dreaded thing called caregiver burnout. Sounds terrible, doesn't it? It is terrible. It's nasty. Well, we have an exciting show planned for you today with my lovely co-host, Adrian Gruberg from the Caregiver Space. And we together will be interviewing internationally recognized author, speaker, radio host, internist, hospice and palliative medicine specialist, Dr. Zoe Lewis. She sounds so important, doesn't she? So stay tuned. You will not want to miss this show. And if you're new to the show, and we get many new listeners every week, especially from the Blab Television Network, I am your host, Dave Nassani, and this show is to caregivers of every kind. And the one thing we know about caregiving is that they are caring, selfless, sacrificial people. Oh, yeah, and they're very prone to burnout because they tend to put everyone else's needs above their own. Yes, folks, learn a lesson from the airline, please. In the event of an emergency, you know, they tell you to put your oxygen mask on first before you help your loved one with their mask, because they know from experience that if you don't, you will most likely black out. And then you won't be of any good to anybody with anything. That's a lot of anys in there. Now, we also talk about grief and loss here and the devastating effects it can have on us. It automatically throws us into this other thing as if we needed another thing. Ouch. Unfortunately, folks, the only way out of the grief process is to go through the grief process. You can't go around it, can't go over it, can't go under it. You got to go through it. So hopefully we can help you through your grief and your loss if you happen to feel like you're kind of stuck. Hey, just a reminder, you can hear all these interviews that we do here on podcast. Just find the link on my website, caregiverscaregiver.com. That's caregivers with an S, caregiver without an S, .com. And while you're there, take our short quiz to see if you're a candidate for burnout. And just for doing that, I'm going to send you my very first book that I wrote absolutely free. What a deal. $10 value. All right, enough of that. I'm going to welcome my guest, Zoe, now. Zoe, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, great. I love it when the guest is there and I don't have to go looking for him. Oh. Zoe, thank you so much for agreeing to the interview. And why don't you just take a minute or two and introduce yourself. Just who exactly is Zoe Lewis?
Well, first of all, David, thank you for having me on the show and having been a prior radio show host myself on Blog Talk Radio. I know how much you must enjoy interviewing people. It's really a great service that you're doing, and I want to invite people that come to listen to my portion of the interview to check out your resources, because they're phenomenal. I've had a chance to look at some of your prior shows.
Okay, so, thank you.
You're welcome. So to introduce myself, I am a medical doctor. I am boarded in two specialties, internal medicine and hospice and palliative medicine. And I work as a traveling doctor. I'm a hospitalist. In fact, I just got home yesterday from working in Colorado. I live in Florida and I work in four different states as an independent contractor. So the work that I do really for the past 10 years is independent contracting hospitalist work that's inpatient acute care. So that's what I do to bring in the bread. I also wrote two books. I hope they know the Essential Handbook on Alzheimer's Disease and Care, which is a book about expert advice for families helping caregivers care for someone with a dementing illness. It's in English and in Spanish. I had it translated into Spanish.
That's cool. I mean, my mother just passed away from dementia this last September. And so I'm very familiar with the disease. And it sounds like that's one of your specialties, huh? So tell us about your book. Tell us about your book on dementia. And I assume it also has to do with caregiving. And what aspect of dementia and or caregiving does it discuss?
Okay. So the book is written for a person who absolutely has no prior medical knowledge. It's not written for doctors. It's written for patients who've newly been diagnosed with any dementing illness. So dementia is sort of the word, it's an umbrella word to describe any illness that ends in a syndrome of certain symptoms, and then cognitive decline, impaired memory, and short-term memory, all of those things sort of make up the umbrella. Is that a dog in the background I hear?
Yes, that's Adrian's little service dog.
Okay.
She needs to do something with him, so I muted her temporarily.
Okay. So the dementia could come from many different things. In fact, that's one of the chapters in the book. It describes all of the different types of dementia. Alzheimer's disease, people end up just saying the word Alzheimer's, referring to dementia, but that's right. Just one of the types of dementia. There's also vascular dementia, Pick's disease. People would probably know of that disease because of the infamy that Robin Williams brought to it. He had a dementia related to Pick's disease. So there's a lot of different types of dementia.
Is that one part of Parkinson's as well?
Yes, absolutely. Parkinson's as well. HIV also can cause a type of dementia. So there's many, many diseases that lead people down to a common endpoint, which would be this terminology, dementia, but it's basically cognitive decline, inability to have short-term memory, create new memory, and then loss of the ability to even recognize family and friends. Spatial orientation gets lost. You know, language skills are lost. So it's a pretty devastating disease.
Wow. Well, as an offspring of a dementia patient myself, how concerned should offspring be that their parent had dementia?
That's an excellent question. I was interviewed when the book first came out by MSNBC. I did a nice interview with them, and all that they ended up picking up was that people are horrified if they've had a family member with dementia because they're afraid they're going to get it themselves. So the inheritability of a dementing illness, if it's something like Parkinson's disease, you know, there is some correlation between inheritability, certainly some forms of early Alzheimer's, but the inheritability or inheriting a dementing illness, as far as Alzheimer's disease, is about 30%. If you look at the second cause of dementia in the United States, pretty much and around the world, it's what is called a vascular dementia. That's when people lose brain cells because of microinfarcts, little small TIAs, which is a transient ischemic attack. Vascular dementia is pretty much related to diabetes and heart disease or metabolic syndrome. And that also would have an inheritable component because people inherit diabetes to a certain extent, especially non-insulin dependent diabetes mellitus. So I hope that wasn't too technical, but as far as Alzheimer's disease, about 30%. As far as vascular dementia, if you looked at parents and families of people who've had diabetes, hypertension, coronary artery disease, peripheral vascular disease, those folks have a higher than average risk for developing strokes themselves.
Yeah. And Adrian, I just want to thank you again for being my co-host. She's such a busy lady, and I just appreciate the time that she takes in coming on the show. Do you have any questions, Adrian?
Not yet. I'm learning a lot.
Okay, I have quite a few, so don't worry about it. If just come in if you do think of one. But Zoe, what are some natural therapies that we can be doing to help in the avoidance of Alzheimer's? I assume there's something we can do to reduce that 30% down to like 10%.
You're asking wonderful questions. You're asking wonderful questions. The book that I wrote, again, it's called I Hope They Know. And there's the first part of the book is really just breaking stuff down so that people have a basic understanding. If they have a family member or a loved one with a dementing illness, or they themselves have a dementing illness and they've been told that they have early or mild dementia, we can get into more about the breakdown of, you know, when you are diagnosed with dementing illness, what the stages there are. But you asked a wonderful question about stress, as far as how to diagnose it. And then I'm going to go into, or maybe you didn't ask that question, but I'm going to ask it and then answer it. You know, what are the alternative tests or the tests to diagnose if you have dementia or Alzheimer's? And then what are some of the ways to prevent getting it? So certainly if your doctor might suspect that you have some what's called cognitive decline, or more than just forgetting where your keys are, your glasses, things like that, memory impairment, you might want to have your doctor check first for reversible causes of memory impairment or, you know, altered cognition. And that might be stuff like getting your thyroid checked, your B12 level. Believe it or not, basic vitamin deficiencies can cause cognitive decline. So thiamine, B12, folic acid, those things certainly. Also Lyme tests for people that may have Lyme disease. They can look at homocysteine levels. Homocysteine levels are looked at for people that may have early coronary artery disease from that deficiency. They're more likely to have, that would be the metabolic syndrome, and then those folks would be more at risk for having stroke. And then certainly a comprehensive hormone panel. People may have progesterone, testosterone abnormalities. They may have markers for inflammation checked. Sometimes people can have memory impairment due to infection or other things. So certainly we look first to see if someone has a reversible cause for their cognitive decline or memory impairment.
Wow, that's a long list of reversible causes of dementia and Alzheimer's. I had no idea.
Absolutely.
It's a good thing that you're a doctor in so many different categories.
Well, the testing would be done usually by neurologists and psychiatrists for somebody that has sort of an unusual presentation, like a young person. But, you know, they would do standard labs would be just, complete blood count, liver function tests. They make sure people don't have HIV or any sexually transmitted disease like syphilis. Those can certainly present with people having, you know, abnormal behavior. And then they would do brain imaging like CAT scans or MRI scans. And they would check other electrolytes. And, you know, if that all panned out normal, then they would do their whole cognitive mental status type exams, and usually geriatric psychiatrists, uh-huh, and neurologists do those sorts of specialized testing. So your question then was, what can we do to prevent? So it goes back to that first question, what kind of dementia are we talking about? So there really isn't anything to prevent Parkinson's. There isn't anything to prevent Alzheimer's disease that we know of now. However, there's a body of evidence to suggest that good nutrition, reducing oxidative damage injury to the neurons, so that means plenty of exercise, and certainly keeping your blood pressure low, and then removing any of the risk factors for heart disease, diabetes, keeping that under control. So that would be my recommendations then.
Are there certain people who are more prone to dementia or Alzheimer's? The reason I ask that is because my mother was a certain kind of person. I used to joke around because she was very funny, and I used to tell people she was a cross between three people: Edith Bunker, Rose on the Golden Girls, and Gracie Allen. And she was just kind of a combination of that, you know, a little dingy, but funny, and I inherited some of that, you know, And so I'm wondering, are those
which
dick
part?
People?
Which woman? Are you more Gracie woman. Allen?
Just a little bit of each one. It's genetic. We call it the curse. You know, some members of our family have it worse than others. Some have it less than others. And we use my mother as the baseline. So, she's been that way all of her life, even as a teenager and what have you. And then when she turned the age of, oh, I don't know, I think it was about 78 or 79, or maybe even 77, you know, she started having some memory losses, and she couldn't hide it anymore because she would always just make a joke. Oh, you know, and she'd say, because she was always forgetful, but this time I think somebody told me that if you forget things and then you later remember it, that's nothing to be concerned about. But if you forget things and it never comes back, then you got a problem. And that's kind
well,
of
that's a good way to look at it. That is a good way. And so you're asking, is there any way to make a prediction? So,
well, if you're those kinds of people, I mean, we all know, you know, people that are a little dingy, people that are very intellectual, people that are, you know, I know a very smart person who got it. So I guess it's not the case all the time.
So this book that I wrote was copyrighted in 2008. It's now 2016. So that's 8 years. In this 8 years, and in fact, I would say within the last month, the researchers for Alzheimer's disease, what the cause of Alzheimer's disease is, people have been researching that for since, you know, the beginning of the description of the Alzheimer's disease, what's the cause, and they believe that it may, in fact, be due to an infectious etiology. They're not quite sure, but it may be viral. So let's talk a little bit about what that, you know, what the implications are there. Alzheimer's disease affects the neurons in the brain. They're the sort of the cells that link together between with synapses. So in between these nerve cells, information is being passed. So if there's a virus that affects nerve cells, for example, herpes simplex virus is one of the viruses that affects nerves. People get herpes zoster years after they've had chickenpox, but there's a bunch of other herpes viruses. They stay dormant in the body. They never really go away. We take medications to suppress them. So there's a belief that potentially that's a trigger. There was just some research published by the British Medical Journal suggesting that there was also a fungal element that may also be culpable. These researchers are trying to figure out, you know, what turns on the destruction of the motor neuron, but then what ends up happening, there's proteins in the neuron that clump, and they're the characteristic findings that we see on autopsy. People don't get the diagnosis officially of Alzheimer's disease unless they do brain biopsies. That's after death, of course. There's specific imaging. I hope I'm not being too technical here, but there's specific imaging that shows, like CAT scans, MRIs, that would be suggestive of. We see atrophy, brain loss, the brain shrinks. The brain shrinks because the cells are dying. The cells are dying because the proteins are clumping up and they just, you know, they die. So there's also a way to make a diagnosis with cerebral spinal fluid. They do cell lumbar punctures and they can check this amount of tau protein. It's not done routinely. It's done sort of experimental, but that's another way for people to know, oh, geez, am I going to get Alzheimer's disease? So.
Yeah. When we come back from our break, we've got to take a break, but we'll talk about this test that I'm taking that my doctor is having me test. I've taken it 3 times every 6 months. They do a baseline, you know, ask you all these questions and to see, you know, if your memory is getting better or worse or staying the same or whatever. So don't go away. We will be right back.
Being a caregiver takes a special person with passion and compassion. But even you can become a little burned out from time to time. The Caregiver's Caregiver Radio Show was developed to help you overcome obstacles, adversity, and burnout, as well as just having a place to rest, relax, and recharge your batteries. We've all been there, and you're not alone. Now, you can take the Caregiver's Caregiver with you. Get the top 25 radio shows in convenient form that plugs right into your USB car stereo or computer. Learn the techniques, tips, and encouragement we all need to better handle the day-to-day challenges. For around $1 per show, just $29.77, Get the credit card-sized USB card to have with you anytime you need a caregiver's pick-me-up. Just go to DaveTheCaregiversCaregiver.com and order yours today. Go to DaveTheCaregiversCaregiver.com now. Consider it an investment in you, and ultimately, an investment in them. Caregivers, have you ever felt like nothing is going right? Well, cheer up and tune into Dave, the Caregiver's Caregiver radio program on HealthStar Worldwide, where you'll learn how to avoid that dreaded thing called caregiver burnout and how to survive the grieving process. With roughly 100 million caregivers in the U.S. and Canada alone, it's about one-third of the population. That means everybody probably knows somebody caring for a loved one. They say that there are only three types of people in the world: those who are caregivers, those who will become caregivers, and those who will someday need a caregiver. Mothers of special needs children, family members caring for elderly parents, spouses, siblings, or friends caring for disabilities such as Alzheimer's, dementia, cancer, stroke, heart disease, diabetes, muscular dystrophy, AIDS, autoimmune diseases. The list goes on. Join Dave and his guests every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Pacific on HealthStar Worldwide as they discuss avoiding caregiver burnout and surviving grief. You'll start feeling better in no time as you begin to receive practical tips and tools that you can start using immediately to help you get through the day and to live life more fully and abundantly.
And we're back with Dr. Zoe Lewis and co-host Adrian Gruberg and myself, Dave Nassani. And we're talking about dementia. We're talking about caregiving. So my next question, doctor, is can this be predicted in advance? Are there tests? I know my doctor is giving me a test. Actually, I'm going, the next one is tomorrow. And they compare baselines. So explain what you know about that.
Again, there's additional testing that can be done on cerebral spinal fluid, and they're looking for this tau protein if they're doing lumbar punctures. They may be doing memory tests with you, and there are different scales that we look at. So I'm going to jump to that. That's actually in my appendix. There's different scales. There's the scale that most providers use in terms of long-term care. It's the Global Deterioration Scale for Dementing Illness. It was created by Barry Riceberg. So it's called the Riceberg Scale. It was published in 1982 in the American Journal of Psychiatry. Believe me, I don't carry this information in my head. It's in front of me.
I'm impressed that you remembered what you did, so you must be far from dementia. That's good.
Yeah, it's in my book. But anyway, they look at cognitive decline, mild cognitive decline, you know, all the way up to very severe cognitive decline, stage 7. And those folks, once they reach that point where they're only able to say maybe one or two words, or they become completely nonverbal, to stage 1, really where they're saying experiences no problems in daily living. Stage 2 is very mild cognitive decline, forgets names and locations of objects, may have trouble finding words. Stage 3, mild cognitive decline, has difficulty traveling to new locations. You know, so this is just a very simple scale. If you're seeing neuropsychiatrists who's doing more in-depth memory testing, they'll do a testing where they ask you, for example, to remember 5 words. They'll say right. 5 non-related words. You're supposed to remember them like 3 minutes out. Or they'll have you do something called serial 7s where you have to subtract 7.
Yes, yes.
Continually. So those are, yeah.
It's a clinical trial. I saw it on the internet and says, you know, if you think you are a candidate for, you know, dementia or your parent has one or something, come and be a part of this free trial. And so you feel really good in the beginning because they ask you really easy questions like, well, what's your name? I said, oh, good, I know that. And, you know, where do you live? And what year is it? Who's the president? You know, all the easy questions. And then they get a little harder. They give you a list of words, and then you have to remember how many can you remember? I mean, at 15 words, I might remember 10. And she said, oh, that's not bad, you know. Just kind of compares you with the average.
Well, I'll tell you, it's a little bit sobering and frightening, I'll be honest with you. There's a movie that PBS put out a couple years ago. It's called The Brain. There's 4 parts of it. I recommend this to my patients all of the time, especially people who are post-stroke. And I know you're familiar with this because of the care of your wife.
Called The Brain.
They look at a brain called The Brain, PBS special. where you can actually get it from Netflix or you know, however you get your movies. But the very first part is the child's brain and the you know, the evolution of the brain to an adult brain. There's a part on a demented brain. There's a part about strokes, and there's a part about people that have mental illness. What's going on in somebody who's got schizophrenia or bipolar disorder?
Wow.
So, you know, it's really fascinating. But for the folks that have a dementing illness, they show you some of the testing that they do. And it, you know, I'm in my late 50s, and I'll tell you, there are days when I'm particularly stressed, and I will forget basic things, like where I put the keys, where I put my glasses. You know, stuff like that. You've just got too many things on your mind. People say, oh, I'm great at multitasking. Well, they've done studies that show no one is multitasking. You're doing one thing after the next in series. So the time frame may be short that you're giving devoted to each, you know, project or thing that you're doing. So in general, for people that are starting to have memory impairment, it may just be a sign, slow down. Take your time. Don't put so much on your plate. Try to do one thing at a time. So since we're talking about caregiving, and the focus then would be on a caregiver who has a demented partner or spouse, people who are caregivers for someone with dementia are constantly managing numerous things, their own life, maybe their own illness, and then other issues, managing the house. You know, there's just way too many things for them to do.
Well, so I know the areas that I struggle with. It's when, you know, my schedule, let's say it's 3 o'clock and I know I've got something to do at 5 o'clock. And at 4 o'clock, I'll still know that I have something to do at 5 o'clock. Then at 4:30, I'll get this phone call out of the blue. It has to be something that's unusual and is out of the blue, like, you know, wasn't scheduled. Person will call me up. Hey, how you doing? Yeah. Hey, I'm going to... you know, go shooting today or whatever in a half hour. Are you free? And I say, oh, man, that sounds like fun. Yeah, I'll be there. And I'll totally forget about my 5 o'clock appointment, just like that. Or I'm on the freeway and I know which off ramp I'm supposed to get off. And I've got my hands free phone and somebody calls me. And then next thing I know, it's 30 minutes later and I've passed my off ramp. So I'm easily distracted.
Right. Well, know, okay. What, so that's what being easily with, Adrian, distracted.
What type of things?
Yeah. Well, my memory at times, I've had ADD and ADHD memory tests, and yes, they can be very scary. They'll give you the list of five words, and they don't tell you that they'll ask you about those five words a half hour later. They check you. You think you know what you're doing, and then wow, it just shows up. For me, most of it is stress, and
it's stress. You're right on the money there.
And searching for the right word, you know, just we use those filler words. And I'm in Toastmasters, so they penalize you when you use and so now I just try to be silent, which I just pretend that's the pause for dramatic effect, you know, and I'm really searching for that word.
Yes.
And sometimes I can't find it. I got to make up a word.
People go, you know.
Well, I think to alleviate some fears, then as we age, our brains have decreased ability for new learning. So let's talk about, you know, it's new learning. That would be a hallmark. Someone who's unable to form new memory, laying memory down in the brain requires like a chemical process, right? So learning something new, like remembering those five words, you have to be not stressed when that task is being asked upon you. So who the heck isn't stressed when you're sitting in the doctor's office and they're going to tell you, hey, and you may have dementia if you can't remember these words. That's already pretty darn stressful. So, but, you know, the unrelated things that happen in a day that you're expected to hold in short-term memory, kind of like a cookie if you're into computers, you're expected to hold that for a period of time to be able to go on and complete another task.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's really the task at hand. If you're asked to remember these five unrelated words, there's other stuff. That's why they give you other tests. So
I need more RAM in my memory.
Yeah. So I think as we age, and then I'll just bring this to the forefront too. If during the age when you were young, you used recreational drugs. There was excessive alcohol. You know, I mean, people who drink or binge drink or people who use recreational drugs can have more accelerated atrophy. I mean, I could tell you, I'm not breaking any HIPAA laws by saying, you know, I work with patients who are relatively young, 30s, and they have significant atrophy of their brain because they drank too darn much. Wow. You know, they smoke too much dope, or they're using drugs today that are synthetic chemicals that really mess people up. They could go into coma. You know, some of the drugs, and we're not talking about, you know, heroin or cocaine, although those can also cause problems. These are sort of the NMDA drug or ecstasy. Some of the other synthetic spice is another drug, or people in poor areas, fortunately, do crazy things like spray Raid on cigarettes and smoke it and think that's a high. So unfortunately, it does cause brain damage. So, or cellular, you know, cell damage. So atrophy, we're not going to call it Alzheimer's disease. It's just you used your brain in ways that, or abused your brain in ways that, you know, there may be some effects, late effects of that. Boxers.
So that commercial of the fried egg and says, this is your brain, and this is your brain on drugs.
Yeah,
any questions?
It isn't
pretty
wrong.
Accurate.
And, you know, the people who, what is it called? The pugilistic boxers who have cognitive decline are big thing about football, NFL, you know, brain injury, post-traumatic brain injury. Smack your head around. Yeah. But football players, too, who get knocked. Anyone who's had concussions, a concussion when you're in an accident, you smack your head, your brain's floating around in cerebrospinal fluid, it bangs the skull on the inside. It discharges some electrical, you know, there's damage there. It discharges your disorders to have brain damage or hypoglycemia, hyperglycemia, constant low blood sugar, super high blood sugars, all of those things. So there's extremes of metabolic brain can certainly mess people up. But get back to what can we do to prevent dementia or make it less likely? There's a chapter in the book, too, on that, so we can go over that. But we're both on the same page as far as caregiving. You, to be a good caregiver, need to take care of yourself first and foremost.
I do have a question. My husband was diagnosed with lung cancer in 2005, and he passed in 2011. And until the last, let's say, 6 weeks of his life, he was totally cognitively fine. And then he just, like, snapped into this state of dementia that would come on and go, I mean, it was like...
Well, that's more delirium. So there's a difference between dementia, which is non-reversible, although there's reversible causes of dementia. That sounds more like a delirium, and that's when people sort of wax and wane with their mental status, and we call that delirium. And delirium...
And
yeah,
they
delirium
they
comes
it.
On... Yeah, it would be delirium, and that comes on when you have, gosh, somebody with lung cancer, let's just say somebody with kidney problems, somebody with anything, that your electrolytes are way out of whack. So your body has to function in this sort of narrow window of optimal parameters. And when they get off or out of that range, you just don't think right, right? You don't think right. You don't move right. So that sounds like what's going on there with him. And I'm sorry for your loss. That, you know, the caregiver is a task that we appreciate doing when we're doing it because we love someone. But the self-love, taking care of yourself first, is really important to remember because you can't care for yourself as well if you're caring for somebody else 24/7. But you got to force yourself to do it, and sometimes people need permission from somebody outside.
Well, the one thing about what I was told that he was going through, they were planning on removing him from the hospital and putting him in Calvary, which is, you know, a hospice facility here, because he was going to be a danger to me. And I heard, and I may be wrong, but that people with dementia more than Alzheimer's have tendencies to be a danger to themselves or others physically.
Yeah, I can clarify that too for you. Okay, so let's just say when a person starts to have delirium or in more advanced stages of dementia of any cause, that can be Alzheimer's, it can be vascular dementia, it can be from Parkinson's disease, whatever. At a point in time, a person can be at risk to hurt themselves because of poor impulse control or hurt others. They hit people. Happens all the time. Nice, sweet little old lady, went to church her whole life. All of a sudden has a mouth like a truck driver and can punch and pull and bite and sit and kick. So people are like, well, that's not her personality. Well, of course it's not her personality. She's got dementia. She has Alzheimer's disease or whatever. So in those instances, people become care issues, and you need specialized staff who are trained in how to work with people like that. Sometimes doctors and nurses need restraints, and restraints would be, hey, if this person's going to fall out of bed or they're going to take a swing at anybody that goes by, you know, they use medications to help calm people down so that they're not, you know, in that state of mind.
Listen, I have so many questions and we're running out of time. So let me just try to ask a bunch in one question.
And real short answers.
Why are diseases like type 2 diabetes and arthritis on the rise? And can anything take care of it, including caregiver burnout? Like, I know you're really into yoga. Can this help caregivers and their loved ones, you know, cope better or even with the diseases?
Yes, actually, I'm going to tell you two things. A really good friend of mine, Jenny Cornero, she has the yoga series of videos. I appear in them as a courtesy to her because I was I'm a student of hers, and it's Yoga for Health. And she does different tapes for different situations. Arthritis, let's just say generalized pain. I don't care what it is. It could be pain of any reason, but certainly breathing techniques and gentle movement and yoga approaches both of those. Good breathing techniques and position, you know, body movements, and certainly the spiritual component of becoming more aware. That certainly helps caregivers. Kino Greger, who's a pretty famous Ashtangi, I met her in India, actually, and she wrote a chapter in my book on self-care and balance. And she, it's chapter 59, Maintaining Balance by Kino Greger. She's been back. Surviving by Fannie Barry. She's another friend of mine. She just wrote a book on plugging all my friends and the work they've done. Mm-hmm. But she's a cancer survivor, and she's down in Tulum, Mexico, and runs retreats for breast cancer survivors. But she's just written a book. So I think finding resources that help you maintain your balance and your awareness of yourself, I think that's really important. And then as far as diabetes, certainly diet, everybody knows now, is key. You are what you eat, and your thoughts become reality. So certainly, good thoughts, good deeds, trying to keep a smile on your face, doing good. And I think those are certainly ideas or strategies every day. I'm going to try to keep a smile on my face as long as I can. And share that smile with as many people as you can, because a frown turns some people inward, and they're already smiling. That frown then gets passed along to like maybe 10 other people. Whereas a smile that comes from nowhere sometimes can just brighten people up, and it's like a chain reaction. So I think keeping your optimism, you know, extending it outward is a good thing. And then I think you asked another question, diabetes, about diet. We are what we eat, so it's not a government's responsibility or a food store or television to tell you what to eat. Your body's telling you what you need. Mm-hmm. And if you're diabetic, a lot of times it can be diet controlled by following the strategies that your doctor would tell you. Most doctors know what people are supposed to eat when they're diabetic, so I'd ask them as a resource. The Diabetic Association has information of certainly keeping your blood sugars down, and that is actually a preventive strategy for any type of dementing illness. For Alzheimer's disease and also for the vascular type of dementia.
Well, thank you for that. We're going to take another short break, and we'll be right back, so don't go away.
One arm, one leg, 100 words. Overcoming unbelievable hardships is a touching story about Charlene, a stroke survivor. Back in 1996, Charlene was a healthy, normal, very active 52-year-old woman whose amazing talents resembled that of both a Martha Stewart and Wonder Woman. But all that changed when she suffered a massive stroke that left her severely speech impaired and paralyzed on her right side. She met her husband Dave 21 years earlier. They had a wonderful fairy tale storybook-like courtship that soon culminated in their marriage. Charlene had just come out of a marriage where after 10 years, she received two black eyes and a broken nose by her former husband when he came home high on speed. Charlene believed in no second chances of any kind for abuse, so she left, finding herself all alone in the world with her 5 and 10-year-old daughters, Cynthia Lorraine and Deborah Lynn. She started raising them by herself for the next 2 years. Then fate brought them all together. After falling in love with Charlene, Cindy, and Debbie, their love then produced Rebecca. They all had a wonderful, normal life for the next 20 years. But today, things are very different for everyone. One arm, one leg, 100 words. Overcoming unbelievable hardships is the amazing story of a woman's fight to survive all that life had thrown her way. Everyone who knows Charlene is thoroughly amazed at how she lives day by day, month by month, year by year, and with a smile on her face and hope in her heart that everything is going to be okay. Her faith in God is her foundation in this hope that everything happens for a reason and what doesn't kill her will make her stronger. She inspires everyone that meets her. Best-selling author Lynn Barrington says, "If you think you have it bad, read this book. This is a beautiful, genuine story from the heart. It is inspiring and easy to read. When you finish this book, you'll be able to look at your concerns in a new light." 9-time Grammy and Dove Award recipient, the godfather of contemporary gospel music, Andre Crouch, says, "Charlene just won't let the promises of God go, and she has not let her circumstances get in the way of her faith. She's not just a survivor, she's more than a conqueror. As the Bible states, you will be encouraged by her testimony, regardless of what you're going through." Order your copy today from the author's website, onearmoneleg100words.com. And Dave and Charlene will personally autograph your copy. Enjoy.
And we're back with Dr. Zoe Lewis and Adrian Gruberg and me, Dave Nassani. And so, Doctor, you're still there, right?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Great. So what's it like being in hospice and palliative care and end-of-life issues? And how, what special issues have you found that caregivers have to deal with when it comes to end of life situations, like in addition to all that other stuff they already have to deal with?
Well, I would say that most people who do choose to work in hospice and palliative care have a understanding that when people are dying and family members around them as a group have unique needs, they're very touched by people reaching out and trying to assist them in their greatest hours of need. And the folks that generally go into hospice and palliative care, at least I'm going to speak on the home health aides and the nurses, in my opinion, are sort of special human beings because they really have an unquenchable desire to help people that are suffering. So I haven't worked with anybody in that field that I didn't feel was some sort of an extraterrestrial, angelic being. So they're pretty extraordinary people that go into that line of work in the nursing field, at any rate, in home health aides. The thing to do, I would say, for caregivers is to reach out to get information about hospice and palliative care services, palliative care meaning symptom management prior to someone being terminal. Most visiting nurse associations or organizations, home health agencies, have palliative care services. That's helping people who have a life-limiting illness. They're not terminal yet. The work that I began in hospice started in Miami. I was working as a hospitalist here in the late 90s, and a lot of my patients were elderly. The community, Miami wasn't the hip place it was in the 90s. It was kind of a place where a lot of people were retired and elderly. Mm-hmm. They would come into the come in from nursing homes, and they would be dying in the emergency room. So I started seeing a lot of patients that really were terminal. You know, they were actively dying. And at that time, the hospital I worked for had an inpatient hospice unit. And so that was pretty much how I got exposed to hospice and palliative medicine from the oral orientation from my work. I since went on to work in New England. I was the corporate medical director for the largest hospice in New England. At that time, we were in like 5-6 states. It was Beacon Hospice. They're no longer under management with the same company from when I worked with them. Mm-hmm. But we extended our end-of-life care, not just being folks that have cancer or end-stage lung, heart, or, you know, brain disease, but to include people that had a dementing illness, because mm-hmm. a lot of them ended up in nursing homes because they needed custodial care. And that's pretty much where most of the information in the book that I wrote about Alzheimer's disease came from. It was in that period of being exposed to thousands of patients that had, you know.
Do they usually all have advanced directives or living wills that
most people do have advanced directives by the time they come on hospice. They've determined that they don't want to be resuscitated. There's a lot of growth now in the area of understanding of what that means, although there was a little bit of confusion, I guess, with the consideration of quote-unquote death panels and all that nonsense. You know, that's actually a fallacy. There is no such thing. Every human being is treated, I shouldn't say every human being, but every American, anyone who hits an American hospital is asked at the time of admission by law, do you have an advance directive? And if you want more information about it, my case managers or somebody in the hospital will come and talk to you about the unique circumstances for the patient, for the individual, what their needs might necessitate, like mechanical ventilation, or if they have heart disease, do they want electrical defibrillation?
I've always thought that that sticking a tube down your throat, a ventilator, for example, is a sign that, you know, it's bad. And I put in my advance directive, no. But I was told that even if you're having something like a surgery on a broken arm and they're giving you anesthesia, that they're going to incubate you for ventilation anyway, yes?
Okay.
So it's not a bad thing, I guess?
Not always.
That's a really good question, because we have the ability to analyze or at least discuss a myth. People that have do not resuscitate orders, that's also a do not intubate order, is referring to irreversible damage to your heart or your lung that requires life support that won't be removed. They're for irreversible situations. So if I know I have end-stage lung disease, like I'm a COPD person, I'm already on oxygen, I've already tried the BiPAP machine, which is a machine that doesn't go down into the lung, it's non-invasive, it just sits over your face and blows air in and helps air come out. I've already decided, hey, I don't want to be mechanically ventilated, which means the tube goes down, you're sedated, you're knocked out because you're on a machine. If you've been on the machine for more than a week, they end up putting in a tracheostomy, and then they hook you up to the machine across your throat, and you don't ever get off of that machine. You need that machine to help you breathe. People say, I don't want that. That's life support. I don't want life support. But if you're down, out, car accident, whatever, and they need to ventilate you until they stabilize you, that's not a do not resuscitate. That's sort of, you know, or I should say, that's not a resuscitation that's permanent. That's temporary.
You know, I see. Well, thanks for explaining that. I didn't know that.
Yeah. See, well, let's just say, you know, most people, again, this is part of what I do, you know, every day for work. Most people who have a life-limiting illness, I'm on dialysis already. I am on oxygen at home because I have COPD. I've got some sort of malignancy that isn't killing me today, but in the next year, it's going to do something nasty. Most people will have had a conversation with their doctor about the what if. and a lot of people choose, if I'm going to die naturally as a result of my illness, the illness is going to take its natural trajectory and bring me to the end of my life, don't sort of keep me alive on machines because you can. I'm accepting that I want to die naturally as a result of my, you know, illnesses, and no one lives forever. So that's really what the do not resuscitates are. It's not death panels. It's odious that people get into this fear mongering and scaring the heck out of people, saying, "Oh, you're going to be old and they're not going to give you care." That's nonsense. There's no doctor that doesn't.
So you recommend that every caregiver should make sure that their loved one has an advance directive now. Instead of waiting until the emergency or the urgency where emotions are running high and all that?
Right.
Well, it's not really. I mean, I don't have an advance directive. You have a conversation with your family members and you just say, hey, most people have. And the way it works, the law is, if you haven't appointed a healthcare proxy, you have not appointed one, the law will follow your next of kin. So I don't have a healthcare proxy. I didn't say I want Joe Schmo to be my healthcare proxy. It's going to be my mother or my sisters and, you know, my family members, my immediate or
husband. And you trust them to make
if you've had a conversation,
decision that's not overly emotional, like you've seen, you know, the Terry Schiavo and other cases where,
they
just want to hang on to this person and keep them alive forever. And
here you go. We have to have another show just about advanced directives. I'm also inviting myself back just to talk about advanced directives and DNR. So I'll make time for you to do this. I taught this up in Boston for a while, and I lectured all over New England. This is part of what I did when I worked in, you know, academic medicine. And advanced directives were something that I felt very strongly about because of the work I did in Florida with people coming in dying, and you're absolutely correct. Oh my God!
And you feel so strongly about them that you don't have one yourself.
Well, I don't think a lot of people. Not everybody has a will either. Look at Prince; he died without a will. So people don't think that they're going to die tomorrow or even today.
Yeah.
However, most people will have had a conversation, usually with fear in mind. Oh my God! Don't do this to me. Don't keep me alive if I'm brain dead. I don't want to be on a machine, you know, I don't want this for myself. So you've had that conversation. It's a fascinating topic. I did a radio show early on about faith-based hospices and about end-of-life care. That was one of my first radio shows. And it was fascinating. I had people from four different types of hospice, you know, religious-based hospices come on and talk about end-of-life care. Orthodox Jews do not believe in stopping any type of care. For example, you're going to be intubated, you're going to be intubated. You're going to do everything. God will take me when he's ready. You do everything as a man you can do to keep me alive. Unless, of course, you know, with rabbi consent, you can show that there's brain death, that you're able to take them off ventilators and things like that. But different religions and ethnicities as well have different beliefs. And so it's sort of examining all of that as well. It's imperative that the patients tell their doctors, and it's imperative that doctors ask their patients, what do you want in the event of? And if someone looks pretty sick and they have critical diagnosis and a critical prognosis, a bad prognosis, they're going to be 6 months or less, that makes them eligible for hospice care. Doctors should be talking to their patients, you know, and it's a hard conversation to have, but that's where the specialty of palliative medicine, hospice and palliative medicine, it's a board specialty now, like ER or gastroenterology. It's a specialization. You take a board exam for it. You do a fellowship for it. It helps doctors, or actually I should say it helps patients. It trains doctors, the specialty, how to have conversation with patients about end of life.
Yeah. Well, Zoe, I can't believe how fast this hour is gone. Yes, we will have to have you back. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And how can anyone get a hold of you?
Okay. So my website is Zoe, Z-O-E, at ZoeALewis.com.
Thank you for listening to the Caregivers Caregiver Radio Program with Dave Nassani. Join Dave each Tuesday at 1 p.m. Pacific or catch the program anytime 24/7 right here on HealthStar Worldwide.